This event is brought to you. This event is called Stadium Media Part 2. It's brought to you by the Halifax Media Co-op. We're very, very, very fortunate to have four great speakers with us today. We have, in order of appearance, we have Gina Baldwin, Regional Executive Vice President of KCC Atlantic. More volume.
Just a little bit more.
Okay. I don't know which switch controls which mic.
The one next to your throat.
Okay! After that, we have Miles States, and he's the president of the Public Service Alliance of Canada, Local 851000, which is otherwise known as the Airport Commissioners. Then we have Kelly Murphy. She's the vice president of the Halifax Dartmouth District Labor Council and also sits on the board of the IWK
MSGU
Local 22, which is otherwise known as the Youth Care Workers at the IWK. And then we have Tony Tracy, who's the representative of the Canadian Labor Congress. So let's have a big hand for everybody. How many people were at State Unions Part 1? Did you have a good time there?
We're back.
So we wanted to build on that. We found that, you know, one of the greatest things about the media co-op, I find, is it allows people to tell their stories, and it also allows some people, if they are so journalistically inclined, to tell stories that might not otherwise get told. So, unless you lived under a rock in Nova Scotia this winter and spring, you've noticed that there's a lot of labor unrest and a lot of labor issues and a lot of union-related issues that are going on. So what we did at the end of February, as many of you know, is stage State of Our Unions Part 1. And what we found at the Media Co-op was there were simply too many stories for one event, so we're having a second event. So without further ado, it is a great pleasure and honor to introduce Jane Baldwin, and she's going to tell us about the federal budget, how it stands to impact labor, and perhaps how it stands to impact us all. Thank you very much.
Well, whoever heard the sunshine, thank you very much. I like the back of me because I know I'm sitting there, the sun be in my eyes. But hey, listen, you know, on Sunday we had snow. Like, go figure, will you? So someone asked me how I ever became involved with the labor movement. And, you know, I think I was 21. I started working with the federal government. I was a single parent at that time. And wasn't quite sure about labor, because in my family it was like a non-unionized household. My father hated unions. So, you know, the whole background was there was no unions in my home. Anything about labor. As a matter of fact, it was almost like the word that you would never say in the house. So I get involved with, I go to the workplace, and when I'm there, something happens in the workplace. I lose my job. And, you know, I found the union, right, because I went to them, and they helped me get my job back. But, you know, I think for me that people say, like, why do people get involved with the labor movement, especially at the workplace, you know? And I think it's because you see something, an injustice at the workplace, and that you want to, you know, help your co-worker fight that injustice, or something happens to yourself, which, you know, happened to me. Or it's because you got nothing else better to do. Right, you have all that time in the world to spend and you get involved with labor, right? So, anyways, so I got involved and this is where I am today. I'm the Regional Executive Vice President for the Public Service Alliance of Canada. I've been working with the federal government almost 35 years. So I've been around quite a bit and seen so much. And when you look at federal governments and their budget, you know, I was there when they rolled us back. I was there when they gave us years of 000. I was there when the 1991 big strike happened. We were able to get the workforce adjustments, and thank God for that, because that's what's protecting our workers right now. And, you know, I've seen some transitions, like in 1998 when we lost 50,000 federal government jobs. And so now we are where we are today. And, you know, when when the Liberal governments gave up power or were ousted out, I mean, at least they had a surplus, you know, in the budget. The Conservative Party gets in, and we're seeing, I think in 2008, a $55 billion deficit, and now in 2010, I think it's a $33 billion deficit. And yet this government still goes out and does reckless spending, right? You know, like, and I'm going to explain some of the stuff that's happening here. So the federal budget is bad for all of our members, and that's the members with the Public Service Alliance of Canada. We're the largest federal government departments, you know, union that represent workers. We have 180,000 workers from coast to coast. We represent agency as well. We represent individuals that work at Service Canada, correctional services. We have workers that work at Canadian Food Inspection Agency, Parks Canada, Fisheries and Oceans, Citizenship and Immigration. You know, like, our list is endless. And the other thing, too, is that people always wonder what we do. Like, what is it that the federal government workers do? You know, those people who have ever been on unemployment, we work at unemployment insurance, old age security, Canada pension. We handle applications for Canadian immigration, passports, residency cards. Our members monitor food, transportation safety. They protect marine habitat. They coordinate marine and rescue missions. And, you know, like I said, like the list is endless of the work that we do. So when you look at quality public services, it's like when you get up this morning, I'm sure most of you brushed your teeth, right? The reason why you brush your teeth is because you know that the water you have just used is safe. You know, you put out your garbage in the morning, you know that the collectors, garbage collectors are going to come by and collect that. Right? So these are, you know, public services that we provide to all Canadians. Even though we don't represent all the workers that work in public services, we represent the majority of them. So, what happened was that we were getting mixed messages from this federal government. I don't know about you, but most of us have. And there was a lot of secrecy behind what was going in the federal budget because they weren't sharing that information with us. As many times as John Wharton, who is our national president, went to speak to, you know, Tony Clements, you know, Harper, Flattery, like, and our own Peter, what's his name?
McKay.
Yeah, you know, you all know him, right? He's the one that takes joyrides, right? Yeah. So, but you know what? It was those four individuals that were making a lot of decisions, major decisions of what was going on, right? But this budget's going to put tens and thousands of people out of work. You know, they're going to put environment, they're going to put health and safety at risk, and they're going to shrink the economy. And this government hasn't wasted any time making some of these decisions. Last Monday, I was talking to John Wharton. He was saying to me, he said his office are inundated with workforce adjustment notices. Monday and Tuesday, we just couldn't keep up with it. And we're getting calls from the membership on a daily basis, asking, have we heard anything? Because they know that someone in their office is going to receive a workforce adjustment letter, which means that they're going to be affected, and they'll probably be out without real work. So, but the most troubling thing about the federal budget, it doesn't tell Canadians. Like, it doesn't tell us what this means, you know? Like, they say they're going to eliminate $5.3 billion in programs and services, but what does that mean? So, an example is that when they talked about some of the cuts, they're talking about back office. Like, so, just to let you know that the last budget that they came down with, one of the things they talked about was Service Canada, which is the employment insurance. So they're going to eliminate 120 of those offices to 19 offices. Well, you know, they provide services to the unemployed, and what we're finding out that there's major backlogs. They call that the back-end service, I guess is what they're saying. Those are the kind of services that we're going to lose. Well, you know, when you look at, well, I don't call it back end, I call it the front end, because this government now is saying you're going to lose the back end. Well, if you just lost the front end and you're going to lose the back end, I'm just going to tell you, it's not much going to hold us together. I don't know about you, but I mean, like, just think of that, right? They call it front end, back end, okay, so what you can say, well, what's in the middle, you know? And how are we going to keep that together? So, you know, last year's budget was $276 million lost in Service Canada. I'll give you an example. 101 positions in Cape Breton are gone. Right? So what this government is saying is that you have a choice, you can move into Halifax. Well, you know, uprooting your families to come to from Sydney, and nothing wrong with Sydney, believe me, right? You know, I've known a lot of people there. But yes, right? Now, but you know, to say that you're going to take 101 positions out of a high unemployment place, right, because that's what it is, and uproot your family to move to Halifax just don't make sense. I mean, it's stupid, really, right? But then, I mean, who's making these decisions? The stupid people, probably. Anyways, and the other thing, too, is that you got seniors who are also waiting longer for the old age security guaranteed income supplement, right? So when we look at Service Canada, we are maxed already. And then what they've done, they took 183.2 out of human resources. Right, so Service Canada is going to lose another $183 million. So we're saying, okay, like, where are these cuts coming from? Like, what's going to be next? So when the other thing the government talked about was immigration, and what you're saying is that they have 280,000 people who have been on a waiting list to have their application process will be soon cut to list. So what you're saying is that any application prior to 2008, we're going to shred them, and then you have to apply all over again, right? So, I mean, those are the kind of decisions that this government is doing. But, you know, I'm just saying to people is that, you know, it's not only the back end and the front end, it's also about this red tape. So when you look at regulations, this is what you're trying to get rid of. So, example, I don't know if any of you are around when 2008 happened with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, where Listeria, Listerosis, right? You know, in the Ontario region alone, 22 Canadians died because of the maple leaf. And what we're saying is that we have workers that go in and we make sure that we inspect your food to make sure that it's safe and they have no worries. Well, we wouldn't want another situation in Walkerton. And you remember what happened in the Harris government? What they did was they cut water inspectors. They cut it so much and they weren't monitoring the water. Next thing you know, we had that big outbreak that happened and people lost their lives. So when you see, like, health and safety, those are the kind of things that are going to be at risk. Well, they're doing something else now under Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Just came out recently. I don't know about you, but I've taught myself now that every time I go to the grocery store, I always look at the label. Anyone look at the label when they go to the grocery store, right? You know, my mom was always one to say, listen, Jeannie, if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it, right? Because I'm going to tell you, you know, some of those words are pretty, like, you're not quite sure what it is, right? So, you know, I go and look. I'm health conscious. I make sure about the sodium, and I look at saturated fats, right? So, like us all. So what this government is saying to going to do now is that we're not going to place that anymore. And Canadian Food Inspection people are not going to look at it. They're saying is that it's your job now to police the companies. So you have to go on the internet, and you take up this packaging, this labeling. You're going to look, and you're going to check every time that you eat something to make sure that it's correct. This is what this government is going to do. Now, I don't know about you. There's lots of people out there that, you know, have allergies. You know, we have people who have diabetes or, you know, list is endless, yeah. And so what we're saying is that, you know, it's just like stupid. It's just like so stupid what they're doing. And then what they've done is that not everyone has a computer at their home. So what have they done? They now cut the funding for the CAP. So what the CAP was a computer system where you'd be able to go into the libraries and isolated areas to be able to have access to computers and your internet. So now the government has quit that kind of funding. So that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, right? And the other thing, too, is that, you know, they want companies to be able to regulate their own food. An example of that, they had a company in BC, and it was a meatpacking company, and under federal jurisdiction, they were in shutdown. But under provincial legislation, hey, listen, they could build the booths. And what did they do? They made sure that now they follow the provincial legislation more so than federal legislation. So, you know, it's just that it's not consistent and it's all over the place. And I'm just afraid of what's going to happen to all of us. Because all we need is just one incident. The other thing, too, is that what you're saying is that there's 19,1200 jobs. Well, we know it's going to be more than that. Because right now, since 2010, we still have 6,300 positions that haven't been, like, eliminated yet. Then we had the hiring freeze in 2010 where we weren't allowed to hire anyone. And then we weren't allowed to hire terms and casuals, right? So if you look at that, that's a lot of people that work with the federal government. And when they say attrition is going to fill these positions, like, you know, through attrition you're going to eliminate, just be clear. Attrition means a job's gone, right? You know, like, let's, because people don't understand that when you think about attrition, you think about a person that's going to retire. Oh yeah, you retire, but they don't backfill the position. And the work does not go away, believe me. So when you look at that, one of the things they say is that it's going to be about 70,000 jobs in the private sector and the public sector that's going to be affected by this federal budget from now until 2015. And I don't believe that's where we need to be. So, you know, one of the things I want to talk about, though, is like, when I say to you about public services, you know, and I mentioned about, you know, protecting natural resources, and it's about public science and research. But right now, this federal government has put an embargo on sciences. They are not allowed to speak to any media. Now I'm going to say something to you. What do you think about scientists? You know, factual information, do the research, right? But this government does not want them to come out and speak up and say anything about any of the research that they're doing. And I would say it's because their information is accurate, this government is making decisions against their guidance of what they're after being able to find. So this is the kind of stuff this government does. You know, we've got the Coast Guard. You know, the Marine Search and Rescue in St. John's, that has saved lives. This government right now is going to close it. And it's going to make a major impact. And the other thing they do is that we don't have no whistleblowing legislation whatsoever, no protection. So, example, we had a worker here in Halifax, who spoke out about the search and rescue. They went in, his employer went in, and escorted him out of the workplace and fired him because he was speaking out against the cuts to search and rescue. Now, we were able to get his job back. What I'm just saying, though, is that they won't put it in the search and rescue. They assign him another job elsewhere. But when you speak about it, or any of us talk about it, then, you know, we put our jobs on the line as well, right? So I just want to mention that to you. The other thing I want to mention to you, too, is that, you know, with quality public services jobs, there's other things that we help deliver. And some of that is, like, peace, democracy, you know, human rights, equality, social justice, respect for Aboriginal people's rights. So quality public services is a really great, it's a great equalizer, both in Canada and around the world. The other thing too is that, you know, when we look at, you know, living in this world right now and the freedom and solidarity, we find that that's being eroded. There's no two ways about it, you know, because we've got this government that's attacking the haves and the have-nots, worker against worker, you know, pension against non-pension. They just continuously have us attacking each other instead of attacking the real person, which is this government when they're making these decisions. So, you know, I just want you to think about this. I want you to imagine something. You know, every time I hear the word imagine, think of John Lennon's song, Imagine, right? But a world without war, you know, or famine, or disease, or injustice. Wouldn't that be great, right? You know, a world with clean water, you know, education, equality for all. You know, we're like no poverty whatsoever. But you know what? I just look around and I'm saying, how are we going to get where we need to be? And I guess sometimes it's about, you know, you coming out here tonight. It's about educating each other about what's happening with this government, what's happened with Canada. You know, we got May the 1st that's coming up, and you know, it's a Workers' Day, May the 1st. And you know, with this budget, this government decided to eliminate the cent, you know, the penny. Right? Can you all remember that, right? And I think that it was a really good way of having everyone talking about the cent and the penny instead of focusing on the elimination of programs and services. So we had talked on May the 1st that we're going to put a penny in an envelope. And we're going to say to Harper that it was a senseless budget. And that we're also going to say to him is that, you know, your days are numbered. And what we're going to find out is how many days from now until election day, and whether he has 3,451 days left, well, you know what, enjoy, because I'm telling you, we're coming after you, and you're getting out. And I really believe that one of the things we have to do it, you know, because it takes one of us talking to our neighbors, it talks about talking to our friends and talking to our families. You know, like, I mean, I talk to my family all the time, and I get really upset when I find out they never went down and voted. Right? Nothing upsets me more. Right? So, I mean, that's what I'm thinking, that one of the things that we have to do is get out there. We need to talk about, we need to tell our stories. And the other thing I'm going to say to you, too, is that, you know, I know political lobbying works. You know, it's not only meeting with your municipalities, but also your MLAs, but it's about your federal representatives, your member of parliament. And if they won't meet with you, because Gerald Kennedy won't meet with me, then I'm going to meet with him. And what that means is that if I see him in the grocery store, I'm going to talk to him. He's not going to like what I'm going to say. You know, if I see him in the airport, I'm going to do the same thing. And that's what I'm going to say to you is that, you know, you got to get in touch with your MPs. And if they don't want to meet with you like Peter and Case, then you know what? You need to find out where they're going to be so you can meet with them. But I'm going to tell you something. They don't want you to meet with them in a public place. So those are the kind of things that we got to do. Anyways, thank you very much.
I know he's a good guy because I met him at a sweat lodge, and also his name is Miles. So.
Well, there you go.
My pleasure to introduce Miles Bates. He's the president of PSAC Local 85100. He's going to tell us about the airport commissioners and the struggle that they're having with their employer and their client. So it's a tangled web, but I'm sure Miles is capable of untangling for us. It's a very interesting story. Thanks again, Jay.
Every time you introduce yourself, I hear an echo. Miles? Where do I begin? Well, you should say start at the beginning, right?
Bring in closer to the mic.
I can't hear you. Can't speak up.
Don't be shy, Miles.
Well, that's one thing you won't find about me. I'm not shy. And also, I'm not politically correct either, so be looking for a politician in the wrong room with this guy. I just call it as I see it. I've been at the airport and worked for commissioners now going on 16 years. I've been at the airport going on 15. I don't know how I lasted that long. I really don't. And they asked me my opinion, and down to they stopped asking. And I think that's what allowed me to stay there so long. 7 years ago, the members out there got to a point where they got tired of how they're being treated. So they decided they wanted to have a union. And Dave Shaw came out and talked to a few members and rounded everybody up and encouraged them to sign up. And they all signed up, and from that point, they didn't know what to do. Really never clue what to do. This is my first experience with this. I'm ex-military, and that was a number of years ago. A previous life, Vito Corleone would be the way I settled disputes and get contracts on. They told me I can't do that. It saved a lot of time. We got our first collective agreement after a few years of negotiating, and we got jammed at that, but we accepted it because we needed a collective agreement to build on. The second go-around has been like pulling teeth from a hen. If you find a hen with teeth, show it to me. Because it took us almost a year and a half to get this employer to bend. I can relate to this employer because it was much like myself. It's my way or the highway. You know, that authoritarian outlook upon life. It works for me this way. But things have changed. People no longer want to be dictated to. They want to be asked. They want their input to be validated. And this employer doesn't quite understand that. I have an analogy they came up with. You know Michelangelo? He took a block of marble and created David. My employer's mindset is like a block of cement. I don't care how much you chisel it, You'd have to refer to David. And what's been happening is they continue to lose context because of their mindset, their outlook upon how things are supposed to be done. They still think for the old military, because even now the military has changed. They have this feeling, because I'm an officer, whatever I say, you do. And if you ask them why, it's like looking at Bambi in the headlights. They don't, what do you mean, why? If you say no, you really threw them up for a loop there. So what they do is jam you. And over the last number of years, a student, and that's the mentality they have, and with the current HIA, the airport authority, they have managers for certain elements like ground transportation, parking, and security. Well, these guys are in charge of security, tourism and security. So here you have a site manager that's ex-military, he's looking for his leader, and he looks at the airport's manager as his leader. Instead of working on the specs of the contract, they run to the general now, because they made it, or the Pope, whatever. And he doesn't happen to like one of my members. Well, you know, there isn't an investigation, it's an inquisition. Well, we get a little tired. We got to the point that this time, if they didn't give us those articles that I collected, we were ready to walk. And they thought we were joking. Well, with 90% vote, there's no joke. And they come to that realization. And some of their tactics was about going out and harassing people. You know, when I first started there, I'd say 90% of the employees working at that site were ex-military with pensions. That's no longer the case. Maybe 40% have pensions. 60% no longer. That's their total income. And those are the people they went to harass to get them to change a vote. And they had them all screaming at me to get to change their vote. And I looked at them, so sad, too bad. It's done. They continued harassment. It took me a long time to get my head wrapped around a whole new way of seeing things. And I realized it's going to take these guys some time to get their head. And the threat of losing that contract, which is a lucrative contract for them, I think was a wake-up call. That got them to bend their knee to realize we have to give some power. And that was a major stroke for this local, to get these guys to admit that we've got to do things differently. They gave up some power. And for a totalitarian, an authoritarian leader, to say, I'll back off a little, that's a major coup. That's a major coup. And what really gave us that boost for the media outlet, because that rally we put really, really boosted it up. And it also gave the airport authority, well, you guys are serious, either buck up or buck out. You know what? This is my experience with unions, and I'm learning that there are other ways to deal with situations besides the deal totally young situation. It may be quicker, but it's messy too. And there's always other follow-ups you have to deal with. But, you know, but what I find so frustrating is trying to bargain with somebody that concept doesn't register. We don't bargain, they dictate. Much like the Harper government, we don't bargain, we dictate. You know, they said George Bush no longer got into the States. No, he moved to Canada. Changed his name. He's got this skull cap he puts on all the time. That Harper haircut? He put over a box and popped on his head. You ever see that photo where he's shaking hands with his kid? Like, whose kid is this? That's his own son. And this guy's the leader of this country? Oh, are we in trouble? We in trouble. And what I've been seeing, why aren't people backing up? I'm still thinking about this robocall. Why haven't they said, you know, you're back from minority government, and we won't have another vote? That boggles my mind, why the masses of the population haven't decided to hold much of that. My mind was back years ago, you know, growing young, you know, to get rid of this crap. I had to get $1.49. Just wait for a little service. We won't go there.
We won't go there.
We won't play that game. You know what? As hard as it is, and this is the mindset that goes around. Last summer in July, there was a conference held in Quebec for all the labor workers. I'm saying I don't know about that. It was a format for the Hartford to economics plan about busting Indians. This is the program in which we're going to follow. If put to mediation, sit down and walk away. Prolonging jam. We're not going to give them anything. We're hoping they'll fall apart and take what we want. Take what we're offering next day. And most people are at the point now they're not willing to. And good for that. And it was about time that people stood up together, not independently, because who does the belt go for? Maybe the guy down the street, but you're next on the list. You know, we're not separate individuals here. We're a collective. And if we continue to see ourselves as separate interests, you're going to find yourself being weeded out one at a time. As a collective front, they don't have the power to stop us. They really don't have the power to stop us as a collective front. But they like to play that special interest game. The special interest that the majority of the population has to realize is you. You as a whole. Government employees provide a service, or else they wouldn't have those damn positions in the first place. Now all of a sudden, you want to cut them back. But big corporations making the money off you, get rid of them, and they'll give you that. You know, Harper's about big corporations, not about the little boy. You don't give two craps about you until it's election time. Then you're going to stay at a party line, tell you what you want to hear, and walk with it. You know, I work at the airport. I understand what I'm saying. Lock a bird, big one. How'd that fly? Well, I want to thank you all for listening to my drive rap. Thanks, Miles. And power to the people.
Raises an interesting point. In a little bit of research that I was doing in terms of reporting, there are certain lawyers within this town that continue to appear or appear to appear in the background of a lot of these contract prolongations, or you know, working on the side of management, prolonging these things, making you wait them out, and they do have deeper pockets. So it was very interesting, and you can click on certain lawyers' websites, and you'll see they specialize in dissuading national unions. They advertise themselves as basically union busters at this point. Thanks a lot, Miles. It's another good Miles around town. Next up is Kelly Murphy. She's the Vice President of the Halifax Dartmouth District Labor Council and also sits on the board of NSGU Local 22, the IWUK Healthcare or Youth Workers, and she's going to talk about the recent cut of jobs that are providing vital services to youth with mental disabilities. So thanks. Let's have a warm welcome for Kelly.
Okay, can everyone hear me? Is that loud enough? Okay, good. Well, first I want to thank Miles and the Halifax Media Co-op for having State of Reunion Part 2. I thoroughly enjoyed the first one and was super excited to hear about the second one and was as nervous as anything when I was asked to speak at it. But I am happy to be here to listen to all the speakers and to get to raise some awareness about the IWK cuts. My name is Kelly Murphy. I am a member of the NSGU Board of Directors. I'm also the Executive Vice President of the Halifax Dartmouth District Labor Council. I began becoming active in 2004 when the company that I work for became unionized. It's a small options in Halifax for a for-profit company with adults with mental illnesses. So this issue is kind of near and dear to my heart. I wrote some stuff down so my thoughts are together and not all scattered. Because I get a little emotional about this topic. But on March 12, 2011, the IWK announced that they were cutting 22 youth care workers within the IWK. These 22 positions add up to actually over 30 full and part-time positions within the IWK. They're within the Adolescent Center for Treatment, also known as the ACT program. They treat severe behavioral and mental health needs. The Compass Center, who treat younger children, and Force Out, which is an acute care center. Anne McGuire, who's the president and CEO of the IWK, defends these cuts by saying they are focusing more on day treatment care as opposed to inpatient care, and doing this as a means to deal with the long and the large wait list. As a result, beds are being reduced. They've actually already removed them from the building. Staff are being cut and actually got notice today. They'll be getting their layoff notices tomorrow. And inpatient care will go from 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, when it used to be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And all this is to programs that have proven to be successful in treating children and youth with mental and behavioral health needs. Programs which the IWK has referred to as an evolution in mental health and youth mental health services. This is moving backwards. Everyone is in agreement that more day programs are needed. They are. They are needed in addition to the programs that already exist, and they are needed across the province, not just within HRM. They should be put in place, they should not be put in place at the expense of the programs in children, the programs that children and youth also need and that are proven to be successful. Community-based care is ideal. Children and youth can be at home with their families, they can go to school and still get the supports and the treatment that is needed. But the reality is there are still children and youth that need care on a 24-hour day, 7 days a week basis. Cutting this service is denying our children the support and treatment that they need and deserve. The recent cuts now have support stopping at 3 p.m. on Friday and starting back up on 3 p.m. Sunday, as if mental illness stops on the weekends. Parents and youth have been involved in these affected programs are crying out for these cuts to be reversed. They know firsthand how these services are needed on a 24/7 basis. They know firsthand just how vital the consistent care is in successful treatment. And not having this as an option lessens the likelihood of success. Parents and youth are scared. They are scared that not having the supports on the weekend when crisis happens, because it will happen, that they don't have the supports of these programs, but more importantly, the youth care workers that provide the support, because they are the consistent, and these families, and the families without HRM will have even less supports than the ones within HRM. Another intention of the changes in these services are to focus more on children seeing professionals, such as doctors, nurses, social workers, etc. And it was planned that LPNs will replace some of the youth care workers in some of the affected programs. First off, children and youth do see these professionals now, so they are already receiving this care. And the statement also undervalues the service that youth care workers provide. It almost implies that they do not provide a professional level of care to these youth. Youth care workers should be highly valued and respected. They offer and bring a wealth of experience and knowledge that cannot be replaced by nurses, doctors, or LPNs. And these doctors, nurses, and LPNs are also arguing this point. It's no one's intention to lessen the work and support that other professions offer, because all have an important role in successful treatment. We are just asking that youth care workers be held in that same regard, as they deserve it just as much as any other profession. The youth care workers are highly trained, qualified members of the treatment team. The role is distinct from the other members of the team. They are with the youth 24 hours a day and often deal with the on-the-spot crises that occur. The relationship the youth care workers build with these youth is vital to their success and cannot be replaced from another profession. So we have a lot of questions. Anne McGuire says that there are no cuts, that it is change in service. But when over 30 jobs are being lost and beds have actually physically been removed, these are cuts. Why are these services being taken away from the most vulnerable population? Why not increase services, not take away something that is proven to work? Minister Maureen McDonald is about 6 months late on her mental health and addiction strategy. How can these changes be made to mental health services before it's determined what's actually needed? And now the fear is that the strategy is just going to be molded around the cutbacks that have occurred. In 2009, Minister Maureen McDonald said that more inpatient beds are needed, and now here we are in 2012 and she's eliminating beds. And we want to know why, and we want to know if they're feeling the pressure of balancing the budget, and now they're balancing the budget on the backs of our most vulnerable. We also want to know the specifics of the new day treatment and community-based services that are going to be provided, both within HRM and rurally, because you're already at a severe disadvantage if you live outside of Metro. There's less services provided, so we want to make sure that in their strategy, whenever they come up with it or whatever they're working towards, this is increased. And we want to know why on earth would anyone ever think that mental illness stops on the weekends. Personally, I am involved for many reasons. I am fighting for workers, for fellow NSGU members who are losing their jobs, and for those who are in school now hoping to become youth care workers themselves, because they understand just how important and vital this profession is. I am a sister of one of the youth care workers that's being affected, and I am a friend to many of them. I'm an activist within the labor movement who sees this as wrong and cannot sit back and say and do nothing. As someone who works with adults with mental illnesses, I know firsthand how important early detection and treatment is, and that consistent support on a 24/7 basis is crucial to the success and treatment of behavioral and mental illnesses. And it breaks my heart to see these children and parents afraid for the safety and their lives without these supports. So I will speak up, and I encourage you all to speak up as well, to use your voice. We have been working hard to get these cuts reversed. We've had 3 successful rallies. One was this afternoon. Mother Nature is definitely on our side, because every day that we have one, it is beautiful. We've had a successful leafleting drop in Dartmouth to raise awareness and promote one of the rallies that we've had. We have a Facebook group and we have created events. The Facebook group kind of took off to a life of its own. We weren't really expecting it. There's staff, youth, parents, concerned citizens that have joined. It's more of a support group of people sharing their stories and supporting one another. I can get quite emotional sometimes when people are really, really sharing really personal and heart-wrenching stories of loss of loved ones and how they're trying to deal and cope with these losses. The Liberal MLAs, Diana Whalen and Kelly Regan, hosted a town hall meeting on adolescent mental illness, which is a complete coincidence, set up before these cuts were announced. But we have youth care workers that attended to raise awareness. We made these t-shirts that have the little girl on it that you see in the leaflet, and it also has reverse the IWK cups and mental health matters on a 24/7 basis. The intention was to wear these t-shirts and sit in the gallery of province hosts, but we were quickly told that that was not allowed as they make a political statement. So we took advantage of it being provincial budget day, and I was determined that these t-shirts were going to be seen. So wherever there was a camera and an interview going on, we were the backdrop, and So we've been known as quite the back robbers. We've got some good airtime with them, and then we're quickly told that we were not allowed on the property with them on. We have maintained a presence of province hosts. We have the support of the opposition parties who are keeping this on the floor, oral questions, late debate, introducing the youth care workers that are present in the gallery, and actually youth care workers got a standing ovation. We're going to continue to lobby MLAs and Minister of Health and Wellness, Maureen McDonald. We have requested that she meet with us and youth care workers, and she refused. We requested that she meet with parents and youth that are being affected by these cuts, and she has also refused. So we will continue to request that she meet with them. We are encouraging everyone to write letters. We have listed on the leaflets I've handed out. And to even if you've written a letter, write another one and just express your utter disgust at the fact that the minister will not meet with youth care workers, youth and parents, because it's utterly shameful. And I just believe that this is a prime example of how involved unions are within their communities. We are fighting for job losses, but everyone's real main concern is the quality of care that our youth need and deserve. And we want to make sure that they have it. Too often, unions are seen as greedy and lazy. And people ask, what does my union do for me? Well, this is one of many things that our union does for us. We do this because we have the knowledge, we have the connections, we have the resources to mobilize. And we do it because we care. And that mental health truly affects us all. It doesn't affect you personally, but it affects people that you know and the community that you live in. And this is affecting our future. We are talking about our youth and our children here, and if we cannot take care of our children and our youth, we are really failing as a society. So I encourage you all to keep up to date with this. If you haven't liked us on Facebook, if you're on Facebook, please go and like us. We're keeping everything up to date. We are not stopping. I think on May 4th, it's Youth Care Worker Day, and then there's Child and Youth Care Worker Week at the beginning of May, so we're going to continue to push this forward. We will meet with the minister. We had a really good chant today. I just wanted to share it with Maureen McDonald had a budget. Cut. So that was a big hit with everyone there. And so we'll continue to be there, and I just really encourage you to share this with the people that you know, get them to speak up and write the letters, because they really do make a difference. And just have a conversation about it so we can make the public aware. So thank you very much.
I'm reminded of the words of Janie Baldwin, and that is, if Maureen McDonald will not meet with you, then you should go meet with her. Her office is in Youth House. So, just saying. Also, do what this says. This is very important. Thank you, Kelly. Our next speaker is Tony Tracy. Perhaps he needs no introduction, but he is a representative of the Canadian Labour Council. Commerce. Sorry about that. In Halifax, in Atlantic Canada. So I believe he will be telling us about what unions do, what unions can do for you. Anyway, Tony Tracy, yeah.
Thanks, Miles. And I want to thank my fellow panelists. This has been a fantastic forum. I really enjoyed the last forum last month, and was very excited to be invited back to speak this time, especially with such fantastic panelists. We heard, certainly from Jeannie and from Kelly about the impact of budget cuts, and of course, as we all know, budgets are about choices. Budgets are about political choices, and I think it's really important for us to be fighting back on those kind of questions. We heard certainly from Miles and Kelly as well about economic struggles in the workplace and how those kind of cuts And kind of the employer's mindset, the boss's mindset, affects workers, affects services that are in place. What I thought I'd talk about a bit, because I think we know a fair amount about the role of unions in collective bargaining. There's a great YouTube video that I'm sure many of you have seen called What Have Unions Ever Done For Us? Done by a group of Australians, and I think many of you have seen it. And it kind of it mimics the Monty Python skit. What have the Romans ever done for us? And the boss in this video, by the end of it, says, apart from maternity leave, pensions, workers' compensation, occupational health and safety, paid annual leave, Medicare, and collective bargaining, what have unions ever done for us? And I think most folks are quite familiar with the economic struggles that we engage in as workers in order to protect our members in terms of their economic viability and their ability to retire in dignity. But I thought what I'd talk about a bit was is what we do in the broader community for unorganized workers, what we do internationally in terms of international solidarity work. So, first off, who are unions? Right? Across Canada, the Canadian Labour Congress represents 3.3 million workers from one end of the country to the other. Here in Nova Scotia, 29.8% of folks who are go to work for a living, who have a wage from an employer of some type, are members of unions. That 29.8% actually is a rise over, it's actually one of the two provinces that in the last year saw an increase in union density. Across the country. Thanks, many thanks to a great union organizer, my brother Dave Shaw here, and others who are good and spend the time talking to workers about what the benefits are of joining a union. And that's very, very important. So nearly a third, 29.8% of folks who go to work in the morning or at night or over the weekend or at any time are members of a union. So, And we know that workers, of course, form unions in order to win better benefits and so forth. I myself was a union organizer, and I'll tell you, and Brother Shaw can correct me if he's had a different experience, but never on a union organizing drive that I ever had folks talk about the need for higher wages. That wasn't what motivated folks. They weren't trying to fight the boss just to get higher wages. That didn't play even the top 30 of things that folks were looking for. They're looking for respect and dignity. That would be the two terms that I would use that really encompass what every union drive I was ever involved in was about. So, taking that aspect of respect and dignity and moving it beyond our own workplace to our communities and internationally broadly, I think is a key component of what unions do. Now, certainly, folks may or may not know that unions have representation on a number of federal and provincial boards and commissions, and a number of committees and so forth. We fight for things like higher minimum wage. And it's not usual that someone who's a member of a union, certainly not with a collective agreement, has been forced for more than one term. It's not usual that somebody in the union would be affected by minimum wage. And yet we fight for a higher minimum wage for all. We, of course, in the trade union movement, can be proud, certainly in Canada, of bringing in maternity leave through a struggle that postal workers, CPW and its predecessor unions, fought in the 1970s and it generalized for all Canadians. And so it's not just union members who are able to take advantage of that, but it's all Canadians. Men and women can now take time off after having a child or adopting a child and be able to spend time with that kid. That's fantastic, right? And this is a benefit that was fought for first, of course, by trade unions. Same-sex spousal benefits would be entirely unheard of if it weren't for trade unions, particularly in North America, fighting for the rights of same-sex partners to healthcare benefits, to adoption benefits in the workplace and so forth. And that, again, is something which has been generalized across the board, and we see a great deal of gains in that area for both unionized and unorganized workers. Health and safety. Certainly, in this province, we're no strangers to health and safety issues. We had, last year, 29 workers who died in a job. This is a province which saw the Westray disaster. And it is a province that the labor movement has been very, very involved in health and safety issues, and will certainly continue to be, not just because of union members, but to generalize that across the board to all workers, so that all workers, when they go to work in the morning, have an expectation that their families and loved ones are going to see them when they come home at night. The trade union movement today is united, all of the affiliate unions, and there's 54 unions that are a component of the Canadian Labour Congress, have been united in a campaign in order to win retirement security for all Canadians. And again, this is not a campaign that has great effect on many union members. For union members, some of whom have good defined benefit pension plans, are going to be able to retire in some level of dignity and have a decent retirement, won't actually see the benefit of seeing an increased Canada pension plan. Because in fact, for folks with a defined benefit pension plan, they'll actually see that money clawed back, as it should be. Actually, that's the way our defined benefit plans work. But for workers who don't have that, workers who are minimum wage workers, workers who have taken a great deal of time out of the workforce, today, the maximum that someone can receive on Canada Pension Plan is only about $900 a month. And here in Nova Scotia, we see folks are only making on average about $600 a month from CPP. And we're fighting to ensure that number is doubled for all Canadians, for everyone who goes to work, that they'll be able to, whether they're in a union or not, be able to pay the rent, put some gas in the car, and feed themselves without having to make these choices that folks are being forced to make. Similarly, we see the Harper attack, and Jeannie talked a great deal about the Harper budget and the choices that they made that certainly weren't in the benefit of all Canadians. But we see the Harper government moving to create a new age criterion for folks on old age security, moving it from 65 to 67, creating another couple of years in which people have to work in order to be able to retire with some level of benefit. And again, this is an area that we've been fighting very, very hard. Not only do we think that this is inappropriate and unacceptable in terms of moving it to 67, we actually think the OAS pays too little to begin with, as does GIS. The poorest seniors in Canada receive guaranteed income supplement. We think that amount is pitifully small and certainly doesn't allow people to retire in dignity. The labor movement fights very, very hard in order to get that number up. Internationally, we've been doing a tremendous amount of work as well. So not only here at home, where we fight for the rights of both organized and unorganized workers, but internationally, we also do a tremendous amount of work. Recently, only a couple of weeks ago, a new trade union center was opened in Haiti with the help of Public Service Alliance, CUPE, who came together because of the earthquake that happened in January of 2010. The trade union center in Haiti had been destroyed. Two Canadian unions come together, fund the replacement, and help to build a new center for trade unions in Haiti. We have internationally have a number of programs, in fact, in place in solidarity with workers across the world, throughout Asia, throughout the Middle East, where we work in partnership with unions in Palestine. Throughout Africa, where we work particularly in the AIDS crisis, but also on assisting workers in helping to form and build trade unions. In South America, where we work particularly on human rights abuses, places like Colombia, where we have many union delegations that go to Colombia to assist trade unions. Colombia is actually the country in which the most dangerous place to be as a trade unionist. At its height, some 45, 46 workers, trade unionists were killed annually. We see that number decrease somewhat, but certainly is still a bizarrely high number at this point. So trade unions here in Canada provide the level of solidarity to workers internationally to be able to operate. We have a certain amount of freedom here that we fought for. Unions weren't always legal in this country, when we stand on broad shoulders of folks who come before us. But we certainly don't see that as a given, and we certainly don't see that as something that we don't want to see extended elsewhere. Certainly the type of trade pacts that we've seen engaged in, whether it's the Canada-Columbia Free Trade Agreement or many other predecessors, have taken advantage of lower wage workers in other countries. one of the key aspects of solidarity that we can provide is ensuring that those workers are organized, that those workers have a higher standard of living, and that those workers can benefit from the profits that their employers are bringing in. So it's not just about complaining about low-wage workers overseas or somewhere else. It's about assisting them to bring up the standard of living, the ability for them to reap the same rewards from the capitalist system as folks in the north have been able to do. In general, I'd say that, spent many years as an anti-poverty activist before coming on to full-time union staff some years ago. In general, I'd say that the trade unions, both here at home and internationally, are the best anti-poverty program out there. The trade unions help to provide, not just for their own members, but help to raise the standard of living across the board, both here at home and abroad. And I think that that's the key aspect of what I would term social justice unions. So I'll leave it at that.
We have a lot of time for questions, which is good because last time we had to stop taking questions. Let's just have a quick go around though. If I know that there are representatives from a variety of groups here tonight, so if anybody has any announcements they would like to make on behalf of their group, any upcoming events. I know that there's some gentlemen in the back, some communist rabble rousers, maybe you want to have an event sometime soon that you want to talk about? Blackwell Society? Yes?
Yeah, there's a mic there that's also on.
Hi, friends. My name is Ron Patterson. I just want to thank the organizers to start off with for a great event and the panelists. So I'm here with my colleague Aaron Dalton, and we're part of the new NSGE Local 57. I just want to say it feels like great to be part of a group because through our process, which the employer fought tooth and nail, we went to a hearing and we won the hearing, which was pretty exciting, but we felt pretty alone at times, right? We're a very small local, and it was pretty intimidating on a lot of levels, but I just want to thank everyone, and we're part of something bigger now, so we're pretty thrilled about that. And I want to obviously support Kelly and the cuts. If we can do anything, because we work with youth and young adults that are recovering from mental illness, and to a person that we've talked to as a part of our member of our group, the youth care workers have been the most impactful in terms of the recovery.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line, period. So if we can support you anyway, we're there for you.
Thanks for me before you leave, brother.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, my name is Dave Harris. I'm with the NSGU as well, so welcome. I'm also on the Halifax Sergeant District Labor Council. I just want to make an announcement that we're organizing a Workers' Talk series to be held on Sunday, May 13th from 1 to 3 at Humanity Cafe in the North End. And the topic is going to be strikes and solidarity with all the issues in Halifax around so many potential strikes and strikes that we're getting over. I definitely like to invite everybody out to that great little talk series. So,
yeah. How about the Peace Coalition?
Oh,
yeah,
right here.
Hey, it's very nice.
May I combine the comments and an announcement very quickly?
Only because it's you.
Okay. I would just like to pick up on two comments that were made by the panel. Thank you very much for your presentations. One is budgets are about choice and trade-offs. And the other one, that children and youth need to be a priority. And I'd just like to add climate change as well. And you know, with those two comments, I'd like to say that the Halifax Peace Coalition is extremely concerned that $25 billion of our precious tax dollars are going to build warships at the shipyard.
This Shame.
This is also a union issue that requires greater reflection and this idea of economic conversion. We prepared a fact sheet, and we'd like everyone to take one, and to consider that a defense economist of the Royal Military College said that 80% of that contract, the $25 billion, is not even staying in Halifax. It will go to Lockheed Martin to build the navigational and the weapon systems. So this isn't even good for jobs. So please take that. And then in terms of upcoming events, we'd like to invite you to a screening of the film Myth for Profit, Canada's Role in Industries of War and Peace, and that's being played tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Student Union Building, and it's a Cinema Politica film. And then, so that's tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the sub. And then next Tuesday at noon at the Halifax Public Library, we're having an information picket for the Global Day of Action on Military Spending, saying no to the warships and no to the stealth fighters and no to the doubling of the military budget. So if you could take one, I'd really be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're also having an event on May the 11th. Our membership month is coming up for the Halifax Media Co-op. We are a sustainer-based group, meaning that our coverage survives through your monthly sustainer money. We greatly appreciate the sustainers in the crowd. And if you're not a sustainer already, why don't you consider becoming a sustainer? So we're having a dinner. Don't go because there's questions here. You can ask many questions. Just look at the leaflet there. Let's open the floor up to questions here. Sharon.
I don't have a comment, but I, as usual, I have something to say. I'm probably going to wrong me board because it's the same thing I said at the budget watch. So please don't be bored. I attended a film series by Megan Leslie, our MP, and it was about the tar sands. I was reminded to say tar sands. In a small First Nations community in Alberta. And the community doctor there spoke out about the incidence of cancer and other health problems caused by the carcinogens that the people were exposed to. Believe it or not, the government put this doctor under investigation through his College of Physicians and Surgeons. That really, really upset me. At the time, I had bought two t-shirts that I had gotten. He heard me say this before, but I'm going to say it again, Larry, because I think it's worth saying, at a fundraiser for Syria. Thank you. One of the t-shirts was a saying had on it by Martin Luther King. In the end, it is not the violence of our enemies we remember, but the silence of our friends. And the other had a quote from a South American woman involved in social justice, and she said on the t-shirt, "I think it is not the words of our enemies we remember, but the silence of our friends." The day after attending the film series, Megan spoke at a social work conference, and she talked about how one of the most difficult parts of her job was speaking truth to power. And tonight I hear our panelists talking about sitting back and saying nothing, and the other one saying, our other panelists talking about a lack of whistleblower legislation. As I feel it's really important for me to bring this message of being involved and speaking out. The apathy really scares me. Sitting back and letting things happen really scares me. We all need to be remain informed and involved, and it doesn't matter how old you are. We all need to be involved and informed. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for our panel? Yes. You can either approach the mic or just speak loudly.
Okay. Thanks very much. This is, both panels were really good, and it sort of gave me a perspective as an outsider what's going on in Nova Scotia. I'm on the PSAC local, I'm on leave with the PSAC local in Alberta, and the one thing that I remember during the leading up to the last election was how demobilized the membership was. I mean, the staffers were putting out fight back campaigns trying to get people out, but there was a way in which the membership wasn't following. And, you know, I also thinking forward to the last election with CLC, the campaign over pensions, over OAS, and I mean, this was part of the election campaign that didn't quite register. I expect that listening to Miles' presentation and also to some of the brothers and sisters who spoke, there is some growth in the labor movement. There is some militancy coming about. And it brings to mind the 1990s and the Harris days and the days of action, where suddenly there was a lot of motion that people didn't anticipate, and there was something to be done. And what happened is it seemed to have led to a McGuinty victory. In Nova Scotia, it's unclear, I mean, as a sister was speaking from NSGU, this, you know, traditionally our politicization might go to the NDP. And now it's unclear to us, like, where would this all cash out? Like, in Alberta, where I was at, I was with the Friends of Medicare, we politicized hospital closures, and now there's a rightward politicization from the Wild Rose Alliance that picked up on this. As labor leaders, where do you see, if things get moving, how will you be responding to that movement? And where do you see, or if you're, what do you see as the blockage behind your members becoming politicized? What is preventing them from, I mean, some members that I would talk to said, well, if we raise a fuss, there'll be layoffs, or they'll just legislate us back to work. So it's unclear to us what we should be doing. So I'd just like to hear your comments about, as we move forward through this and as it potentially heats up, what are your roles going to be? How do you see yourselves dealing with that?
Good question. I think, though, what happens, though, in workplaces is the fair, right? There's no two ways about it. So, example, when the federal election happened, you'll see that departments send out emails to every employee with the federal government and tell them that they're not allowed to engage, they're not allowed to wear a button, they're not allowed to have a sign on their lawn, they're not allowed to endorse the candidates, they're not allowed to work on candidates' campaigns. And what happens, we go out with the information saying, no, that's all wrong. But it's really hard, right, to counter that when the employer is after saying to them is that you can't be involved. So I think for us, though, it's about educating the membership. And the other thing, too, is that they're a very powerful organization. I mean, let's be clear about it. Whoever has that power, when I look at Harper, because he's fired people. He's fired scientists. You know, he's, you know, like we said, we haven't got a whistleblower legislation. But this time around, what we've done, though, is that we've engaged the membership to call steward schools. And it's worked really well. So what we've done is that, you know, we've listened to the membership. And some said, like, it's about information not getting down to the grassroots. So what we've done now is that we've done a series of stewards forms right across the whole from coast to coast, especially here in the Atlantic region, where we had a lot of membership go out. And they were very thankful because it's about the education. It's about mobilizing, you know, and engaging them to be active. Because what we say to them is that if you're not out to vote your employer out of power, then you're continually to give them that power, right? So, but we found that the stewards and the mobilization and education is really working. So that's something that we were doing.
Just to touch on the stewards network as well, Halifax and Dartmouth, the District Labor Council, are going to have a stewards network. It's coming October 27, so we'll be putting out information on that. So we think that's going to be a huge success. I think a lot of people think that
they don't do anything because it's not going to make a difference, and we're not sharing success stories as much as that we should be, and sharing what action that we are taking. A lot of people haven't ever done any sort of action, so it's important to take along a friend with you, so they can just feel comfortable. If they've never been to a rally, or if they've never been to a panel discussion, or things. A lot of people are scared to go to those things on their own, so I always try to take a buddy with me, or at least offer it up. What I'm going to do personally is I'm going to be there for whatever. I'm going to bring some energy, I'm going to bring some people, and I'll continue to fight, so that's what I'll do. So bring it.
Maybe I'll start with just following up on Sharon's comment before I come to Anthony. Sharon had mentioned Martin Luther King, and I think it's really important to note that last week represents the 44th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King. The night before he was shot, he, of course, was speaking for sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, did the amazing speech of Bend to the Mountaintop. The work of the civil rights movement in conjunction with the trade union movement was absolutely crucial in winning rights. And that's another example, of course, of the work of the labor movement in conjunction with other social movements. And I think the story of Martin Luther King and his links with the trade union movement is one that we need to tell and retell, especially with the 44th anniversary of his assassination just a week ago. To go back to Anthony for a bit, I mean, what we see is, I mean, I would describe it as mixed and uneven consciousness, right? So on the one hand, we have many workers, both civil servants employed by governments as well as private sector workers, who vote for the Harper Tories, right? And that happens, right? Frankly, if roughly a third of people across the country who were members of trade unions voted the same way, then we'd see very different federal and provincial and municipal governments than what we do today. And so, within people's mindset, people oftentimes do stuff which is counter to actually their what actually is their only interest, right? So, on the other hand, in times of struggle, you actually see folks really step up and change in a great way. We saw this just a couple of weeks ago in Toronto at the Pearson Airport, where a number of folks, having been ordered back to work, and we're not in any workplace. Across the board, we're not talking about folks who voted the same way, think the same way about politicians and so forth. But yet, in the course of actually being attacked by Labor Minister Lisa Raitt and others, started a minor protest. It was actually just a slow applause, and of course Lisa Raitt, having never seen applause before, was confused at what exactly it was, and called for the security to come and deal with this thing that she'd never seen. And that resulted in actually a wildcat strike, right? Which is fantastic. It's exactly what should happen in that case. We see when workers are going to the line. I think it's we do a lot of labor education. I think labor education is crucial and important. We have weekend schools, we have week-long schools, and the best education, however, is either on the picket line or in struggle in conjunction with your coworkers and others. And I think that's incredibly important in terms of changing consciousness. We see people change dramatically throughout the course of struggle with others. Now, certainly in the labor movement, I mean, we take inspiration from other places as well. And many of us were incredibly inspired by the Occupy movement in September and October, seeing folks, pitch tents up and physically occupy space and talk about, things, beyond, just, we need to defend against this, we need to defend against that, thinking really broadly about what we want as a new society. We're starting to see a lot of discussions around that, and I certainly personally feel we'll see more and more of that. The days of action in Ontario were incredibly interesting as a case study, and I was I lived in BC, but I flew in for many of those days. The one that was the most inspiring to me was the day of Toronto. The city of Toronto was effectively shut down. The subways didn't run. The buses didn't run. I mean, the city was, except for the rallies, the city was practically a ghost town. It was absolutely amazing. And I think, frankly, we made a mistake in setting the next day for Thunder Bay. And you know, 2 weeks later, we went to Thunder Bay, and you know, we brought a lot of trade unionists, but it really brought the momentum down. I think we have to think not just about action on the streets, but about a strategy with it, not just about the tactic of bringing folks out, which is absolutely incredibly important. People radicalize in those moments. People, you know, see themselves in a much more confident way in those moments. But I think we have to think about a strategy that you know, takes us somewhere, rather than in that particular case. I think, in fact, ended up taking us backwards, with Thunder Bay becoming much less of an event than the event in Toronto only 2 weeks prior. So I think we've learned some from our lessons. I think we still have a lot to learn. And I certainly have tremendous hope and optimism, particularly in the new, renewed, and reinvigorated social movements, you know, like the Occupy movement and others.
And I have a great deal of respect for what you do, and you know, I've had a part in organizing this, so I'm very happy that you came. My question, sometimes do you ever find that you're putting jobs ahead of other stuff? I'm thinking, I did some research and did a story or a few stories on the Northern Pulp Mill up in Pictou. And just in terms of the environmental disaster that is Bode Harbor, and the sale of the mill to basically a shell company from an Indonesian conglomerate with a terrible track record, environmentally speaking, and then the CEP coming out in favor of the sale and not necessarily making any mention of the need to address the environmental issues, or perhaps, as Tamara was saying, you know, the CAW and building warships. Do you ever find that that's a conundrum for you? Are you putting employment ahead of, for example, militarization of the economy, or perhaps speaking up against an environmental catastrophe?
There's definitely a tension there. There's no question. There's absolutely a tension between workers' ability to continue to pay the rent and the mortgage and drive the car and so forth, versus the climate and environmental justice and justice in other respects. Absolutely, it surely is. I think we've made some tremendous leaps in the last 20, 25 years. I mean, I first joined a union and was a pulp and paper union, one of the predecessor unions to CPP in 1985. I was 17, and at that time it was pretty uncommon in 85 to have environmental committees within unions. Certainly, my union didn't have one. It was pulp and paper workers. Today, that's quite a bit different, and we're starting to see. I think largely it's because of better coalition work with social justice partners and others, but we're starting to see some moves in, I think, the right direction. So on a national level, for example, Communication Energy and Paper Workers, Brother Dave Coles, who's the president, went to the line and actually was arrested over the issue of the pipeline. Right? And in Alberta, energy workers, folks who work in the tar sands and so forth, CEP has the highest number of workers in that sector, and yet the union on a national basis has taken the position that we oppose this pipeline down to the U.S. for a whole number of reasons, and one of them is climate and environmental justice. And there are other examples like that. At the Canadian Labour Congress Convention, this may sound like something that should have happened 30 years prior, but it did involve a lot of debate over decades. But the Canadian Labour Congress Triennial Convention just last May in Vancouver, finally, a motion was passed by the 2,600 delegates in attendance to oppose the export of asbestos. This has actually been a massive issue within the trade union group. Asbestos kills people. We all know asbestos kills people. But of course, there are a group of workers who make their living from the mining of asbestos and the extraction of it, as well as the processing of it and the export of it. And for many decades, this has been the position of the trade union movement, was not to oppose the export of asbestos. No, it's not. It's changed. Right? We have a long ways to go, but I think we actually are moving down a path. Right? And I think the more that we see coalitions interaction with social justice partners, the further down that path we go.
Other questions?
Yes.
I would like to thank you, too, for a really interesting presentation. The asbestos issue that you raised is a really interesting one. And maybe if the one that, or one of the ones that challenges the Union Movement to think, what more can we do to get to be the society we want to be? So it maybe isn't enough just to say Canada shouldn't export asbestos. Maybe you have to work with the workers in asbestos to have alternative kinds of jobs.
Very true.
And is that happening?
Yes.
And yes, it is happening, and certainly the workers in asbestos Quebec have been part of the debate. I think, you know, still to this day, you know, and the debate's still pretty fresh. It, you know, a vote was just taken again last May in Vancouver, the Triennial Commission of the Congress. But yes, the Congress and union affiliates, including CEP and many, many others, have been focused very much on a green job strategy. Because we need to green our economy, there's no question, right? We need to find ways to have sustainable, you know, climate-friendly, you know, jobs for folks. And so that's one area. Certainly with the hopeful, and Harper opposes us on our position on exports of asbestos, of course. Harper wants to continue the export of asbestos. There's effectively no domestic market for asbestos because it kills people, and we don't want to be killing people here. Harper seems to have no problems with killing people somewhere else, but there's effectively no domestic market. We want to end the export, and actually you'll be able to retrain workers and have, you know, something else for workers to go to other than this extraction of an incredibly poisonous, which of course affects the health as well as the health of places where it's going.
No?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It doesn't matter.
And then,
I just had a question about educating young people. Like, you talked about labor room education, and I graduated last year from school of social work at Dal, and I remember being in one of my classrooms and our professors asking us who in the room is a member of a union, and no one raised their hand, and I thought, we're all members of the student union, what do you mean? And people, I don't think, realize the importance of it, and I think a lot of people too are believe that inaction equals neutrality, but I don't support that viewpoint either. And I guess, like, I know there's events like this that go on in the community, and I went to the labor dispute talk that I think we spoke at, and I found that really amazing and learned a lot. But I'm wondering, unless you're studying business or what have you, but even in my social work degree, I didn't learn enough about the importance of labor movements. My mother was heavily involved, and so I learned a lot from her. But I guess I'm just wondering if you could comment. Oh, and I guess also because of the recent bus strike, and a lot of students were affected by that, and then they spin that around and say, you know, like, union people are greedy, whatever. So then this becomes like the forefront of what comes to mind when they think about unions now, too. So, like, how do we bust those myths and whatever and educate young people that are more involved? Because, I guess I'm just speaking as person.
I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done. It needs to start in school. It needs to start before university. It needs to start before college. Because youth, 16-year-old people in high school are working, and they need to be aware of their rights and unions. Health and safety, for sure. I think we could do a lot more work with student unions to try to gain that awareness in universities and in colleges and things like that. And we need to put in more effort on our part to connect and to share our knowledge and try to mobilize the students and just increase the education.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I think we have a lot of work we can be doing. I think there is some good work going on. The Canadian Federation of Students, I really do see as our partners
in the social justice movement. We work with them very closely on a number of things. We help to support their campaigns, and they certainly have supported work of trade unionists, certainly here in Halifax and across the country. I was privileged a week and a bit ago to spend 4 or 5 days at a labor school in Newfoundland, in Terranova, with the Newfoundland Labrador Federation of Labor, and they made this brilliant choice to invite a couple of Canadian Federation students activists from Morley University to come as participants, and also to present to a couple of classes, but come as participants to the labor school and be amongst some 50 or 60 trade unionists who were going through a 4 or 5 day training program. And I think that we need to do more of that. We need to generalize that more and more, integrate that. And so certainly there needs to be a ton of education work, and if somebody can reasonably get through public school easily, and certainly I think in most universities through university, without the topic of trade unions ever coming up at all from the front of the room. And that's, I mean, frankly, bizarre. I mean, there's almost nothing else that we don't talk about throughout the course of public school that somebody is as affected by. As I said originally, I mean, only a third, 29.8% of folks that go who have a wage, who go to work at all here in Nova Scotia are going to be members of unions. I would say social work program, that's going to be far higher, as an example. And frankly, in an MBA program, it's going to be pretty high. It's not going to be that much lower at all. Maybe in skilled trades, it's going to be quite a bit higher. So why aren't we talking about trade unions throughout the course of education? I think it's incredibly important that we do that. But on the other hand, I don't want to just blame teachers, right? Because these folks are folks who are seeing increases in class sizes and all kinds of problems that they're seeing. So what can we do? And I think part of it is integrating folks into the work we're doing. Part of it is us going out to the work that's going on in the broader community. So it's as much as possible, we try to encourage members to join student marches and rallies, to come to student forums, to actually hear and work with students who are working with us in social justice coalitions on issues of tenants' rights, on issues of all manner of issues that are out there. Tenants' rights comes to mind as one that it affects virtually all students and many, but not all workers for sure, as many workers own their accommodations. But it's an area in which we certainly have a great deal of commonality with the students, and an area in which we can do a lot of great work in common.
I believe we've come a long way, so compared to where we were. When you look at the university sector, I know myself and Joan Jessam have been asked to come to some of the Women in Politics classes to talk about why unions and the benefits of unions. So that's kind of educating others of where we are and why we do the things we do. And even within our own labor movement, though, is that we've been out trying to get young workers, to get involved, right? So, example, we put off young workers retreats, or what we do now is we designate most of our education and residential education to young workers to make sure that we have some representation of young workers. And even the end of May, that we're combining our school with the CLC Atlantic School that's going to be happening at Antigonish, which is at a university, so it's really important. And the other thing, too, is that if you look at organizing, where we are in organizing right now, we're organizing teachers' assistants at universities, plus lecture unions at universities. If you look at the university sector, even in the Atlantic region, in Quebec and Ontario, you're seeing that there's more organization within that, right? So we've come a long ways, but we still have a long ways to go.
I just wanted to touch on too is that NSGEU has a young activist committee, so it's for workers that are 35 and under trying to engage younger members within NSGEU. Also, as the Vice President of the Nova Scotia Federation of Labor, I'm Chair of a Young Workers Committee. We're going to be getting going soon, so it's in a, kind of the mandate that we want to set, but I know last year we talked about just that, getting into the school systems and increasing that education. CLC also has this fantastic education. It's called X, Y, or Boomer, which really gets people to look at their own generation and the other generations and gain this mutual respect and understanding for the different age groups. Trying to build that generational gap, that's one of the courses that is going to be offered at the CLC week-long school in Antigonish. There's also a two-day program. One's being held in the Valley in May, May 11th and 12th, I think. Halifax is going to be having one in October, so I encourage you to all go for that, because it is it's a fantastic program to be a part of.
Just one last thing. I think in Nova Scotia, we're actually quite lucky. We've got of labor councils throughout the Nova Scotian area, and there are five active labor councils. Two are fully led by folks under 30, so the youth leading, you know, presidents of labor councils. And then I look at the executive. I mean, from the time in which I started working, for example, with the Halifax Dartmouth District Labor Council, some 5 years ago, I looked at the composition and, you know, the demographics. And I look today, I walk into the room through an executive council meeting, and virtually the entire room is filled with folks under 35, both at the executive level and at the delegate level. And it's really rejuvenated things. We're seeing a lot more. I mean, folks will notice, you know, on, there's virtually no rally or demonstration in town, but we don't have young folks from the District Labor Council in a very prominent, supportive role.
Megaphone.
Megaphone, exactly. And Kyle with his radio will be here tonight. But, and I think it's really important, right? And these folks, I mean, the youth committee is absolutely crucial, for sure, training and so forth. But these folks have actually, it wasn't a tokenized position they were given. They weren't given a position because either nobody else wanted it or because, they were given the position just because they're youth. Absolutely not. They fought their way up and took leadership within their locals, within their unions, and within their labor councils. And I think that's absolutely crucial and important as well. And to provide this space, I think it's really important for those of us who, are follically challenged and all that. And I think it's important for us to provide the space for these folks to come up and to be able to challenge for leadership and not be, squashed down every step of the way. And we do see that happen. There's no question sometimes what happens is when folks, start to challenge for leadership in their, early, mid, late 20s, that, they start to make some waves. And sometimes, some of us can be a little static. And when we're a little static, we can push back against those waves. And I think it's really important for us, again, that follically challenged of us, to step aside a bit and to let folks come in and take over.
And our Labor Council meeting is tomorrow night, 7 p.m., 3700 Kemp Road. Everyone's invited.
Alan?
Sure you want to call on another follically challenged person right now? Well, I do compensate. Thank you, panelists, and thank you, Media Co-op. There was a struggle going on. A couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, called a transit strike, and for 6 weeks I was trapped in Spryfield, so I couldn't come to the first in this series. But I read the articles and the enthusiasm for it, and so I was strongly, and I've enjoyed tonight. I would encourage Media Co-op to continue these. I don't know if they have started entertaining, what panelists, but I would recommend, as a Nova Scotian, that fisheries is an important issue. The attacks by the Harper regime are atrocious. What they're doing on the front of the fisheries, particularly in attacking the inshore fisheries, etc., and the attempts to monopolize into the big fishing companies, etc., the industry. Also, that ties in with the attacks on fisheries from the environmental front, which most of you are perhaps aware. But I think to have somebody from unions in that industry would be worthy of Media Co-op to call. We are Nova Scotians, and that is a historically important aspect of our economy and our political economy. I would also encourage Media Co-op to have because we are Haligonians and Nova Scotians and Canadians and have this obscenity of the shipbuilding, warship building contract in our city that we're supposed to bow down and anyway, I'm expressing my own views there. I think that the Canadian Auto Workers Union, their local shipbuilders, shipyard workers, should be encouraged to come here, give their perspectives, give their internal dynamics and contradictions, which Brother Tony started to elaborate on, the conditions of the membership versus some other issue. It would be very interesting, and Media Co-op is a body that could pull that off, to have them come and deal with that delicate issue. My organization, we have very strong views on it, but we have to learn to work together, and I think those are two. So if people do have suggestions of continuing part three of this unions and the state of our unions, I'm sure Media Co-op would like it. A couple panelists have talked about the budget. I'm flogging this, which is just a reprint of some articles on the federal budget if you want to see me after. A couple of upcoming issues. Warships. With the tall ships. We're familiar with tall ships, yeah. I'll be very brief. We're familiar with tall ships. And we go and we see these lovely tall ships, or they're down in the harbor. More and more and more, they're bringing in current Navy warships, NATO warships. They're following up the eastern seaboard, wherever the tall ships are now. There's massive British and American and Canadian and several other countries' warships with it. There's three German warships that I think will be with the tall ships this year, or they may, I'm not sure, Navy ships, as well as a British nuclear warship submarine may be coming with tall ships. So everything's not nailed down yet, but that type of thing has happened. I think that's worthy of Haligonians to protest. In September, DEFSEC is coming up. They just announced their dates at the Kennard Center, the Defense Industries. So warship production, you know, is going to be the major topic there. Tamara, who's just left, and a few others here historically are down there protesting that. I would encourage it. The Halifax International Security Forum, which is the big NATO conference, now organized out of Washington, D.C. The Halifax International Security Forum is now based in Washington, D.C. But they've announced their dates in November. I would encourage you to come out, because all of these issues are so related. So I thank the Media Co-op for organizing this. I encourage you to continue and make any other announcements of coming events and that. Thank you.
I have an immediate announcement. Is this anyone else's piece? Leather boot?
I one thing you should remember is that there's no separation between Media Co-op and not Media Co-op. The slogan of the Media Co-op is own your media. So if you're not owning your media yet, it's not that there's any reason not to. So you should. We're only the ones that kind of picked up on the notion of owning the media. So Media Co-op is your media as well. You know, so it's anybody needs tutorials about how to become a member, we'd be pleased to walk you through those when this is finished. Otherwise, I do encourage you to sign up if you do know how and write about whatever you feel, truly. And, we do have also weekly meetings, 6:30 at Humanity Cafe on Mondays. So please do come down. We have a staff of reporters, geeks, and editorialists who would love to copy edit your stuff. You can't imagine how much they'd love to copy. So hilarious how much they'd love to copy. So are there any other questions? Then perhaps we'll leave it at that. I urge you to do what this pamphlet says. I urge you to join up in a union. I also urge you to question unions. And I urge you to give a huge hand to our panelists here. grab some information, magazines, stickers, t-shirts.